us. Testing. Testing. I was so blessed last week to have a chance to be with my family. And I do especially want to thank Dorian Coulter for allowing me a few days of sick leave last week. By the way, precursor to next year, we're probably going to be working on paid sick leave for all Marylanders next year, but that's another story. I'm so happy I have it at my place of employment. I was able to spend a couple of days with the sheets pulled up at home, and then to drive to my mother's house in Rhode Island and to sleep in my mother's house for a couple of days. And then I was in Rhode Island just in time for Brown commencement. And a weekend that always holds a bit of nostalgia for me, but a weekend that also has me thinking about what it meant for me to be a student in Rhode Island back when I was. When I was in high school, the black students at Brown occupied University Hall, shut down the university for about a week, until Brown was willing to address with a real plan of accountability the racial composition of the student body. And then later, when I was a college student there, another occupation took place regarding the composition of the faculty and the tenure system and commitment by college to increase the gender diversity of the faculty as well as the racial and ethnic diversity. And that kind of made me proud of the kind of activism that formed my social consciousness. I was interested to hear when you said that we do service trips to Haiti and we're making real change. For the Haitians, yes, but I will tell you from the people who come back from those service trips, it makes change for us too. It increases our consciousness, increases our sense of connection to other people, broadens, I think, our soul and our spirituality. Maybe more about this later. So I wonder if you know what people say about this city, or at least what people said to me when they learned that I was coming to Baltimore. No, no, it was not warnings about the homicide rate. No, no, not even the Smaltimore stuff. People told me, you will love the markets. Lexington Market and Broadway, of course, but Waverly's 32nd Street Farmers Market that was managed by a member of our church, I was told. You'll see it on my Foursquare. I say I'm at the happiest place on earth when I'm at the market on Saturday morning. And people spoke about the Sunday morning market with some trepidation, wondering if it was a place that stole people from church, but that's another story altogether. Markets. Markets are great places where we are free to experiment, to taste, to try, in some places to argue and test, some places to haggle, some places of trying to get coerced. Markets are places where the real prices of things are set. A real consumer approaches a real provider and they find together the real price of things, what the market will bear. The market is a place of exchange, of social communication and order, which is basic, essential, and necessary. What is life but approaching that place of social communication and exchange, of being with one another and finding the things that will allow ourselves to be sustained? In the market, we find the things that we eat and we find the things that we drink. We soak in some sunshine, which is necessary for who we are to sustain life. We can live life to its fullest extent. At its most basic, life is a series of what some people call agricultural acts. Wendell Berry's essay, The Pleasures of Eating, reminds us of the following. Eating is an agricultural act. Don't say that you're that far from the farm. If you eat, you're participating in agriculture. Eating ends the drama of the food economy that begins with planting and birth. We sang a harvest hymn just a moment ago that said we start with planting and we bring it in to be eaten. The food economy begins with planting and birth, and we all get to participate in agricultural acts, big and small. Well, I want to talk about a big picture agricultural act, and this comes a little bit out of my own experience. And I'm going to talk a little bit about Cuba. I was first attracted to go to Cuba back in the years when we were occupying University Hall. I remember that brown activism that helped form me. Wanted to go harvest sugar cane with the Venceremos Brigade. It never quite got together for me at the right place and time. I finally did get to go to Cuba with Pastors for Peace, and at that time learned about the profound challenge to Cuba, which was about food. And what had happened, of course, was that in the early 60s, when the Cuban government nationalized all the land and began to set up large-scale agriculture by people who otherwise had been in subsistence plots, the model that they used, well, the first, of course, they approached the United States about normalizing relationship, and that would be the easiest place to get the kind of technology they needed, and we instead put up barriers and pushed them into the arms of the Soviet Union. But then what happened is the Cuban eating economy got entirely caught up in its relationship with the Soviet Union and the Socialist Community of Nations. So by the time the Soviet Union collapsed, Cuba was entirely dependent on huge petrochemical infusions to keep its agricultural industry going, and those things didn't exist anymore. And very, very quickly, they had to learn to grow food on their own. There was a period when you could look at a group of people and you could see all these people who were this tall, and then suddenly there were people who were this tall. And it was this group of people that had had profound malnutrition at the end of the Soviet period. So I got to Cuba with Pastors for Peace, and this was a time when we were sending direct aid from U.S. churches to Cuban churches. I got a chance to go back several times in the next few years, largely to work with a Presbyterian group, the Center for Christian Dialogue and Reflection. This is not a big group. This was four churches that together decided that they were going to do something different. And they created the Center for Christian Dialogue and Reflection, whose subtitle was, "If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem." And they taught each other how to do organic agriculture. They taught each other how to do small plot agriculture. They taught each other how to raise pigs and use the pig manure for the crops. They taught each other how to raise pigs and use the methane that came out of the pig manure to fire their stoves. They taught each other how to can vegetables. No one had canned a vegetable in 35 years. All the canned vegetables came from Eastern Europe. And so they had to teach themselves to recapture all of these capacities. And I discovered that one of the things they talked about was food sovereignty. That part of the security of their nation was that they were able to create the food that would feed themselves. And largely, they have moved to, we don't have a generation of children who had malnutrition anymore. Well, that's kind of a big picture. But we have some little pictures, too, about the agricultural acts that we have, both the agricultural acts of buying, eating, and the agricultural acts of creating systems by which agriculture is produced. But our experience at Dayspring, and we think of the fact that our congregation and some other UU congregations, just a small group of people, decide to embark upon a project by which we will assist people in growing some of their own food. Now, it's not all of their own food. We're far from that. But it's the beginning of having some sense of food sovereignty, of people who can build their own garden, tend that garden with friends, and have some produce that results from it. And we hope some community that results from it too, and some encouragement that there are people that they can depend on to grow into all the capacities of individual sovereignty that the families coming out of Dayspring hope to find. Another big picture, little picture thing that happens around the UU Service Committee, and particularly in Haiti, is that the UUSC works with the Mouvement Paysan Papay, the Papay peasant movement called MPP. And I'll tell you, my experience with MPP in the 1980s was about pigs. And I don't know if you know this, but the Haitian government contracted with Midwest pig growers and Midwest corn growers that they essentially only had Midwestern pigs growing in Haiti, being fattened up with Midwestern corn to be processed and shipped back to the Midwest, essentially. Now, this was fine, except it was totally unsustainable for peasants who couldn't afford a pig. They could work on the pig farm, but they couldn't even have a pig of their own. And so the MPP was about the reintroduction of the Caribbean pig into the Caribbean, and giving peasants access to pigs that could eat what was the in the ground around them in the central plateau of Haiti. These were not pigs that were marketable back to the United States, but that's okay. To the peasants, a cash crop didn't mean a whole lot of anything except misery, because the more they worked, the more cash went to somebody else. You heard from Father Aristide's sermon. So my experience in the 1980s was helping to reintroduce the Caribbean pig to the Caribbean. But what are we doing nowadays? Here's how environmental manager and Unitarian Universalist minister Catherine Jesch tells Haiti's story. In the early 1970s, a charismatic young seminarian from a peasant family imagined that self-determination and justice could be established by the peasants for themselves. Informed by liberation theology, Chavon Jean-Baptiste studied agronomy and launched an organization called Mouvement Paysan Papay, the Papay Peasant Movement. The organization is known by its Haitian acronym, MPP, and named for the village on the central plateau where it was started. MPP grew quickly to reach tens of thousands of peasants, empowering them with technical skills, collaboration practices, communication networks, and advocacy for their own rights. By the time the earthquake struck Port-au-Prince in January 2010, MPP had already become central to daily life for thousands of poor people. With the city in shambles, hundreds of displaced residents fled to the central plateau to stay with relatives or friends. Nearly 800 of these survivors ended up camping in UN-provided tents at the MPP training center, where they remained for several months. This was a huge strain on the marginal resources most of these peasant families could ill afford, but they felt obligated to accommodate them as far as possible. Eventually, the burden was too much, and many of the displaced were reluctantly asked to leave. Promises of disaster relief were pouring in from around the world. Two ex-presidents of the United States committed billions of dollars. A hospital ship anchored offshore to provide medical support. Food aid was promised. Photo ops abounded for us to come in and help the poor Haitians. Bags of food commodities, including seeds for planting, began to arrive in Haiti a few weeks later. Monsanto, yes, the global chemical company that developed genetically modified crops, moved quickly to get its rice seed into Haiti. And the peasants were so anxious to begin planting when the rainy season started, but when they learned that this rice was genetically modified variety that was sterile and would not produce seed that could be planted, They were incensed. Accepting this seed would mean that they would be forced to buy new seed every year instead of setting aside some seed for next year's crop. This was a travesty, totally unsustainable, and they were righteously angry. And an uprising began, and MPP was part of it, and 40,000 peasants gathered to show their anger, and instead of planting the seed, publicly they burned it, sending a message to Monsanto that genetically modified seed was unacceptable. Meanwhile, some of the survivors who camped at MPP asked to learn how to become farmers so they could sustain themselves. And in response, MPP developed a model that they call as an eco-village and set out to make that model a reality. Each village would be consisting of just about 10 households, total of about 50 people in each village, would maintain an organizing and decision-making group to ensure quality and ensure participation by every family. Each household would plant its own vegetable garden, and the community would establish larger agricultural projects that they would manage together. And they could choose to raise chickens, pigs, or goats. They could choose to plant fruit trees or other vegetables. They could choose to grow field grains, such as rice and corn. And those communal projects that they created would be the possibility of a cash crop to the extent they wanted to put something forward to the world market. And then the money that would come back from that would help with some profound expenses of each village: school costs for children, supplies for non-agricultural businesses, transportation, infrastructure for the village. So the current goal is to establish 6 eco-villages. The UUSC raised the funds for the first village, and it was built in 2011. And then the Presbyterian Disaster Assistance Agency, the Emergency Refugee Program of the Presbyterian Church USA, pledged to build 4 villages, and those are now under construction. Villages 2 and 3 were completed in 2012, and Village 4 was completed in 2013, and Village 5 is now under construction and will be occupied in the next couple of months. So number 6 is out there, and UUSC is nearly finished raising the funds for the 6th eco-village, and our hope is that construction will begin soon. All of MPP's efforts are aimed at achieving food sovereignty. In the last 7 years, MPP has been joined by several other peasant associations across Haiti to provide a broad range of self-help and development activities aimed at improving peasants' quality of life. Last fall, that collaboration was awarded the Food Sovereignty Prize, which spotlights grassroots activism for a more democratic food system. In honoring those who are taking back their food system, the Food Sovereignty Prize affirms that nothing short of the true democratization of the food system will enable us to end hunger once and for all. And Siobhan Jean-Baptiste says, "It's a fight that must be waged both locally and globally and requires deep solidarity among all organizations fighting for food sovereignty." End of quotation. So our UUSC helps us find deep solidarity among those who promote food sovereignty for the people of the earth. UUSC helps us consider microwaves, like building 6 villages with 300 peasants in the high plateaus of Haiti, or a garden with a few dozen mothers and children, and a few congregations being in solidarity as allies. And macro ways, global ways, that address international disparities and promote sustainable ways, including not creating infertile seeds, but that's another story. Sustainable ways for all of us to live on this planet, our home that we share. You know, this Unitarian Universalist faith, that shapes our attention and responds to our action and intuition. This faith matures as a community of people experience each other and desire from that experience to change, to grow. William Ellery Channing and Ralph Waldo Emerson and others of our forebears spoke of self-culture as part of our faith. And they meant that the selves that we are, the souls that we are not yet where they need to be. We need to be cultivated, just like plants need to grow. The seed needs to be planted. Our souls are like seeds. We need to be planted in fertile earth and exposed to brilliant sun and watered by earth and maybe being given time to mature. A. Powell Davies at All Souls in Washington, D.C. declared that the purpose of a human life is to grow a soul. And so even as we want seeds that are planted to sprout and to stretch and to reach for the sun and to blossom and to fruit, so do we want our hearts to open to love, our lives to evidence, generosity, and interconnection, our church to exhibit all the virtues of patience and sobriety and charity and fortitude when challenged, and unity when we might otherwise be divided, and confidence in a time when we might otherwise have despair, and humor and welcome, and as the old universalists would proclaim, happiness. Wouldn't it be wonderful if our church were full of happiness? With Unitarian Universalists around the globe lighting chalices together, with our special partners in the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, with the thousands of Unitarian Universalists who will gather later this month in General Assembly in Providence, Rhode Island, we proclaim a confidence in this life that we share, in our capacity to think and plan and act in macro ways and micro ways, for sovereignty around food and sovereignty in all aspects of human living. And we cultivate well the seeds of justice in the garden of love, that we might promote hope in the living of these our days. By every holy name, by every generous act, by every evidence of justice, in love. Amen.